It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll check out a new survey that looks at the news consumption habits of Americans and where we like to get our information from.
But first, the film adaptation of the novel Divergent by Veronica Roth opens this week. The film will surf the same wave of fanatical devotion for dystopian stories that help put Hunger Games over the top. And our next guest says that dystopian films and books are notable for another reason. They feature kick-butt heroines who appeal to both men and women, and that's a rarity in books and film today.
Devin Maloney joins us now. She's a contributing writer at Wired Magazine. Devin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's give a quick listen to a clip from the trailer for Divergent.
Everyone's afraid.
But not you.
They're looking everywhere for people like you.
Divergence will destroy our society.
You're wrong.
Everyone's afraid but her. Can you give us a quick rundown, Devin, of what Divergent is all about?
Sure thing, yeah. It's a story about this girl named Beatrice Pryor. She changes her name later to just Tris. She lives in a world where society is divided. It's basically post-apocalyptic Chicago, and society is divided into five different sections. And every section is basically dedicated to a single virtue, whether it's abnegation, erudite, amity, and so forth like that. And basically, that's the way to keep the whole world running smoothly. And so, this girl, when you come of age, you get to choose which section you belong in. And she chooses, she's grown up in abnegation, and she chooses Dauntless, which is the fearless protector section of society. But she basically takes this test that tells her that she's actually divergent, which means that she doesn't actually fit in any one of these five sections. She could fit in one of three of them. And this is a very, very dangerous thing because the people who run the society are very against this. It kind of disrupts the stability of the society, so she has to keep it hidden. And so that's where the first book and the first film centers is on her going to Dauntless and learning about this faction while also keeping herself hidden, her true identity hidden.
Now, as we mentioned in the introduction to the story, this dystopian as opposed to utopian look at society, you know, shows like Hunger Games or Maze Runner, those sorts of things, are more common now. And so I've got a two-part question. Why these plots? Why now? And why do heroines figure so prominently in them?
Well, I mean, it's good that it's a two-part question because first you have to ask yourself, why are dystopian stories so appealing in general? And I think the answer to that is that we have a lot of anxieties about the future constantly, but they become even more we become even more attracted to stories about a depressing future because they allow us to explore those anxieties. And I think that it became a really powerful trope in young adult fiction, and particularly with these heroines, because it's a great way for young people to see their own anxieties expressed, not only about getting older, but about getting older in a world where we might not necessarily know what's out there for them. You know, their futures aren't as secure as, say, previous generations' futures might have looked. So I think that's why it's kind of gone towards the young adult and largely, not largely, because there are a lot of men who've read these books, but it is aimed towards these young women who are able to explore a lot of the issues that are coming up in the real world through these stories.
Is there an empowerment element here where these young women can rise up and succeed in the face of not just the everyday challenges women face now, but a dystopian society stacked against them completely?
Oh, totally. And I think, you know, all the dystopias that we've seen over the past, you know, few decades, going all the way back to Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, they were a way of, you know, parsing the way that our world is now. And young women in particular have a hard time. You know, you see a lot of things going on, world issues and within just the United States, women's issues being constantly attacked. And I think that this is a way that young women in particular are able to see themselves succeeding in a future that looks as depressing, if not more so, than things are now. And I think that they're a really great way to position powerful women in negative situations and seeing them succeed or not, but just navigating these places powerfully and you know, as active characters.
You mentioned Huxley, and you know, I think of Orwell at the same time, but if you fast forward a few years to authors like Margaret Atwood and A Handmaid's Tale and those types of books from the 80s, you know, in those books, women were sort of marginalized. They became second-class slaves. Do you look at books like Divergent and Hunger Games sort of in that vein of being feminist writing, or are they something less than that?
I think that they are certainly in that vein. I think that they serve different purposes. Margaret Atwood is she's a self-proclaimed speculative fiction writer. She's not writing specifically about dystopia. She actually wrote a column for the Financial Times last week, about a day or two after this piece that I wrote came out, about why we're so transfixed by dystopia right now. And you know, she for The Handmaid's Tale, she made sure that all of the things that were coming up in her world were things that already had a precedent in society, things that had already been done in you know, Western governments, and things that could possibly happen. You know, places like Divergent, the worlds that are described in Divergent, it's very unlikely that they're going to happen, and so they're a little bit different in that. They're much more of a tool for young people and adults too to really explore issues. Whereas Margaret Atwood was, I think she's saying a lot more about society, and she's being much more of a critic than I think Veronica Roth was. So it's I think that they are definitely under the same umbrella, but they serve different purposes in society.
There's a notion in pop culture, I don't know how true it is, but the idea that with a male lead in a book or movie, men and women will both watch it. With a female lead, it's mostly just going to be women who read or watch it. Are these dystopian heroines in things like Hunger Games and Divergent breaking that idea a little bit?
I don't know if they are themselves, but I definitely think we're in a position nowadays in pop culture where that paradigm is sort of shifting in what constitutes a powerful character, a compelling character. For a long time, what constituted a compelling character was usually written as a man. You didn't have very many strong female characters, and by strong I mean complex, like actual humans, characters that made decisions that weren't necessarily all the good ones. You can tell throughout the Divergent books and throughout the Hunger Games books that Triss Pryor and Katniss Everdeen are making choices that aren't necessarily in their best interest or in the best interest of the people around them, but you know why they're making them, and they are incredibly complex. And I think that the evolution in literature and in pop culture is towards a more diverse playing field for more different kinds of characters. And I think something that the producers of Divergent told me, where they were talking about what draws them to a film or to a project is compelling characters. And I think that the more you see a more diverse range of characters, the more people will interact with them and engage with them. And I don't think it has anything to do with whether it's just you know, characters like Triss in dystopian stories. And I think anybody can engage with any character that is portrayed as a human being.
If people are liking Hunger Games and Divergent as books or movies, can you leave us with a recommendation or two for some other good reads?
Sure. In my piece, I mentioned Lauren Oliver's Delirium trilogy and Marie Lu's Legend. Of course, the Maze Runner books are being turned into a movie coming up soon. But I mean, I'm currently speaking of Atwood. I'm currently getting through her Mad Atom trilogy. That's actually where I would put my recommendation. She's got a great trilogy. It starts with the book Oryx and Crake and moves on to the Year of the Flood, and then the third book is Mad Atom, and it's a great stepping stone, next step in the exploration of dystopian worlds and female empowerment.
That's been on my should read list for years now. Devin, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. That's Devin Maloney, contributing writer at Wired Magazine.
A new survey out this week from the Media Insight Project shows that Americans are getting their news from a variety of sources and mediums, and that there is a real desire out there for solid, meaty news.
The poll also challenges the idea of the filter bubble, the notion that with limitless choices, people are only going to follow a few subjects that they're interested in and only from sources that they agree with.
Here to talk more about those findings and what it says about our news culture is Tom Rosensteel, Executive Director of the American Press Institute. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, it's a great survey. I had a chance to take a look at it this morning, and there's a lot to it. And so I strongly encourage people to take a look at it for themselves after they hear the interview. But it starts out in the introduction, contrary to conventional wisdom about media consumption. What is the conventional wisdom about media consumption these days? If I were just to walk up to a professor somewhere or somebody who follows the news, what would they tell me what Americans are doing?
Well, what I hear most often is people only get information that they agree with. They only go to the sources that confirm their preconceptions, and that everything divides along generational lines, that young people only get news from social media, from Facebook, and older Americans, you know, read the newspaper. And neither of those things is true. It turns out that 15 years into the internet age, we've become pretty rational. We use the device that's convenient at the time where we are, and we're interested in a wide variety of things. If you define news as, you know, something more than just politics, but, you know, you're talking about weather and sports and all the things that comprise news, people are interested in a large diet of that across. And there's very little difference across generations. In fact, we asked people in detail about 15 different topics, and there was only a statistically significant difference in generations on four of them, and the only distinction was between people over 60 and those under 30. Across all the other age groups, the interest levels in all of these topics was very similar. So, you know, the idea that somehow one generation is uninterested and passive and doesn't read the news, doesn't go to news organizations. Not true.
So before we get into the results of the survey, where, in your mind, did all this conventional wisdom come from? Is it people just talking to each other or what?
Well, you know, I mean, we have infinite choices now, right? The user is in control. We live in a consumer-controlled media world. And I think then people are fearful, and they think, "Oh my goodness! Well, if we can't force this on people, my kids will never know anything, you know, or if Fox News and MSNBC exist, then that must be how everybody behaves." And I think it's partly out of anxiety and partly out of the fact that things are changing, so we leap to a conclusion about where the change leads.
One of the takeaways from the survey is on the first page of your introduction, and it's kind of it's pulled out of the text, and it was something that really caught my eye. There are five devices or technologies that majority of Americans use to get news in a given week. The average American adult uses four different devices or technologies for news. And when you combine that with that generational finding that you mentioned before, to me, that is just a real startling fact.
Well, and if you think hard about your own behavior, you realize, okay, well, I do, you know, I see stuff on TV. And, you know, sometimes I'm on a tablet, and sometimes I'm on a computer, and sometimes I'm, even if I don't subscribe to the newspaper, I see it. I see print products. I see magazines. I pick them up. I'm at the dentist's office. You know, some of this stuff sort of comes at us, and the there was a scholar a few years ago who said it's not true that people don't read newspapers anymore. What's disappearing is the 7-day a week newspaper reader, but not the idea that people don't read a print newspaper.
Yeah, in fact, in your survey in that introduction, there's a graph. And of the 6 sources of news, 3 are ones people are going to, you know, TV, radio, newspapers are still there. But you see those computers, those cell phones, those tablets sort of encroaching on that. And are they taking eyeballs away, or are they floating the whole boat?
You know, that's a really good question. They're floating the whole boat. People who have cell phones are more likely to use social media to get news, but they are also still very likely to go directly to a news site and a news organization. And the more gadgets you own, the more likely you are to just get news from many different places. So the habit of getting news leads to getting more news, and having more devices leads to getting more news. People who have more devices are more likely to say they enjoy getting the news. And that makes sense to me because it's actually easier to do. It's in your pocket. You can, the bus is late or you're stuck in line or you're waiting for your spouse to show up. You pull it out and sometimes you check email, but sometimes you check out a sports story or you go to the homepage of, or you go on Twitter, and if you follow any news organizations, you're getting news that way.
You know, it was interesting when I was taking a look at this survey, I was reminded of an article I read a couple months ago in The New Yorker that took almost, I don't want to say the opposite viewpoint, but the title of it was, "Doesn't Anyone Read the News?" And it was talking about a dearth of interest of people looking at particularly what, you know, they defined as political news. But I took 2 different things away from these 2 stories within a few months of each other. Why are we having that sort of, I don't want to know if I want to call it a disconnect, but sort of 2 different interpretations of kind of the same thing?
Well, for one thing that's tricky is that it's very hard to know how people are behaving across devices from looking at the data that comes from what we call analytics. So analytics are, you know, how many people are on cell phones every day and how many people are on computers or how much time do people spend on tablets. That tells you about tablets and that tells you about cell phones. But you're not actually tracking people, so you can't figure out what's that person doing across devices and across technology. The only way to get at that is through survey work, at least at the moment. And that's expensive. Surveys are done, this kind of in-depth survey about news consumption is done maybe every couple years. And what we did in this survey is we said, let's invent questions for the digital age that are not the same questions that people have been asking since the 1960s, because those questions, while they can track change over time, a lot of them really don't work anymore. The terms don't make sense, and they were built around the idea that people do the same thing every day and that they have just a few places. So the questions in those traditional surveys are things like, where do you get most of your local news? What we did in this survey is we said, where do you get news about schools? Where do you get news about your favorite sports team? Where do you get news, or do you get news on these topics? And if so, from where? And what you discover when you do this is actually people don't get most of their news from any one particular place. They go all over the place. But the questions hadn't been asked that way before. And the other thing we try to test here is, can people tell the difference? Do they distinguish between the discovery mechanism that they got for news and the news organization that gathered and reported the news? Do they think that Twitter is a news organization, or do they think Google is a news organization, or do they know Google's an aggregator or a search engine and Twitter is a delivery platform? The answer we got was pretty overwhelmingly, yeah, people not only make that distinction, but when they're in social media, they are pretty selective about what links they click on. If they think it's from the New York Times or some source that they like, they're much more likely to click on it. And they tell us they trust news from those brands more than they do from other places. So people are much more sort of conscious than we sometimes give them credit for.
Lots to talk about. We're talking with Tom Rosenstiel about the way Americans consume their news. And we'd like to hear from you. Do you consume news from a variety of sources and mediums? Do you crave news with substance? And how far are you willing to go to get that news? We're talking with Tom Rosenstiel about how Americans choose to get their news. Talking about the results of a survey conducted by the Media Insight Project and found some interesting things in terms of how Americans access news on a variety of platforms and the types of things that they choose to pay attention to. Tom Rosenstiel, one of the things we were talking about right before the news was this idea that people are selective, that they do look for some sort of credibility, and that sort of flies, you know, there's been, I think, this perception lately that people are just sort of passive, that they'll just, whatever comes up in their device is real, and they don't really look much further than that. But your survey sort of paints a different picture.
Yeah, actually, we found that rather than being passive, people are pretty rational and self-directed, and that the biggest determinant of where people go for news is actually the subject of the story. So they pick very different places to get their weather versus sports versus arts or technology and science news. They pick different places for local news and news about their kids' school. And the choices they make are ones that, when you think about it, make a fair amount of sense. There are a range of topics now that people say the first place, where the most popular place or most cited source are actually specialized news organizations. So sports, more people go to specialized news brands than they do general local news publishers. You know, their local newspaper or local TV. Same thing with science. Same thing with celebrity and entertainment news. They go to... They're very likely to use apps for weather, but not for other things. The newspaper is still the go-to place for most local news, for schools and education, and also for arts and culture news that's local. And, you know, that makes a certain amount of sense when you think about, well, what could you get? You know, could you find that information on a local TV station? Or, you know, or are there local nonprofit things covering the city council or not in your town? A lot of towns, no. So what you see when you drill down by topic is a kind of a rationality and a certain common sense. People have gotten used to technology, and they use it. Now, we think we understand that when we talk about, you know, hey, you have a cell phone, you have a smartphone, what do you think of it? We're not surprised that people are pretty competent in using apps to live their lives. But when we think about people as news consumers, we think, oh, gosh, you're just lemmings.
So a couple of questions here about sort of the implications of the survey on two fronts. One, in terms of a news consumer, what are the implications of the survey? And then the second part of the question, in terms of news producers, radio stations, websites, you know, newspapers, what are the implications there? Because everybody is going to be heading in the same direction. We all got to live in the same space. But I think we're in this period of transition right now.
Right. Well, for news consumers, I think, to take those one at a time, we're much more curious about a wide range of things than we think. What those things are changes some with as we sort of move through our lives. So we see, for instance, that people under 30 aren't that interested in schools and education, and the people who are the most interested in that are people in their who are over 30 but below 60. Well, okay, those people have kids in school, but people are interested in lots of different things as they are relevant to their lives, and it's a much wider spectrum. And we have a lot more common ground or much more of a public square than we think we do. We may not have it about national politics, but we have it about a lot of other things. what it means for news producers, I think, is not that the medium is the message, but the topic of the news is the message. The news itself is the message. And that means, I think, that if you're a news publisher, you've got to decide what it is you're going to be really good at. You can't sort of be the old general store and that, you know, sells nails and flour and hats and blue jeans and and saddles. You've got to be really good at some things so that people will come to you, because a better kind of content, a better source for that information is always a click away in the digital world. So what is it that at Wisconsin Public Radio, what is it that you are going to be really good at that your audience will turn to you for and they won't turn to anybody else? If you can't figure that out, you've got a problem. And if you think you're just going to be their only news source, the place they turn to for everything, you're living in the wrong era.
And I have to ask, we've only got about 30 seconds or so left, but are there media outlets out there that you don't think are up to that challenge of trying to define what it is they're good at?
Well, I think it means you've got to actually understand your listeners, your audience, your data. You've got to become data companies. I think it also means that you've got to make some tough decisions. You've got to decide what it is that you used to do that you don't do so well anymore. Maybe you never did that well. And you've got to be honest with yourself about it. It's a little bit like, you know, deciding that you're actually not going to be a rock star when you get to be maybe 20.
Yeah, I'm already there.
Okay, so you're on your way.
Well, Tom, thanks so much for being with us today. Fascinating topic.
Thanks.
Tom Rosensteel is the executive director of the American Press Institute, and we've been talking with him about some of the ways that Americans are consuming their news. It's time for Teach Me What You Know, our weekly segment where we learn a new skill. Last week, a Wisconsin farmer taught us how to make maple syrup.
Well, change of pace this week. Our guest looked into strategies to help us find a life partner. He's Tim Urban, co-founder and writer at Wait But Why. You can find him online at waitbutwhy.com. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, really good. Well, let's start with the basics. Why is the process of choosing a life partner so important?
You know, it seems like it should be obvious. I feel like what I wrote about was completely and utterly obvious, and people should have read it and said, you know,
duh.
And instead, people said, you know, wow, I never thought of it that way, and you know, that's why I wrote the post, because I just think it's obviously so important, and people, for some reason, maybe it's that it's just too daunting to think of how important it actually is.
Well,
and it's just easier. It's easier to pretend it's not, you know, that it's all going to all work out on its own anyway. But yeah.
Well, that's the thing. People think, and you mentioned this, that it should be easy. We'll meet our soulmate. It'll just happen magically. We shouldn't overanalyze. This is not something you can engage your brain in. Why is that counterproductive?
Yeah, it's amazing. That's the thing that that you need your brain to be the sharpest for. That you need all of your wits about you for more than you need it for anything in your career or anything else that happens. That's the thing that we decide, yeah, don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't go out of your way to work too hard to find it. It's the kind of thing that just works out on its own. But that's not true. Look at all the bad relationships around you. Look at all the bad marriages around you. It's not, that is a false hypothesis there.
Well, part of the problem is there's this magical spark we have with someone, but does that play out over, you know, the long haul, 30, 40, 50 years? Is that where we start to get into trouble?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the natural spark is really important. I think a really good 50-year marriage probably should start with some kind of exciting spark. It's just that, you know, if 10 things can get that spark going for you, probably one or two of those might be actually something that can sustain. And people need to think about, they need to think about that part as well, not just the spark. The spark is not enough reason right there. It's like walking into a restaurant and liking the liking the vibe and deciding, you know, you're going to eat every meal there for the rest of your life without really looking at the menu, without looking at the nutrition, without, you know, it's just a weird thing to not think that hard about, yeah.
All right, well, let's start from the beginning. Supposing we're looking not for just a life partner, but a good life partner, what should we be looking for in another person?
Let me just also start by saying that I'm 32, and I'm not an expert on this. I'm not a relationship expert. I'm not married. I have relatively thin relationship experience.
But, Tim, you're a blogger, and that's the important thing.
Yeah, exactly. There's all the credibility I could ever want. No. The fact is, this is not I don't think that this is, you know, I wasn't trying to advise anyone on how to be in a marriage and how to be a good husband or wife. Mm-hmm. That, I'm really no pro on at all. But I think that everyone is a pro on how to be a life partner if you just think hard about it for a second. If you just think logically about it for a second, I think that, you know, it's not about experience, it's about logic. And just thinking about the facts of what a marriage entails. How many hours, how many dinners, how many years, and you're raising kids together, and you're going on every vacation together. And those statistics alone is all you need to be able to write this post and to be able to think about this. So that's kind of where I was coming from with it.
And you talk about a traffic test to help evaluate someone. What is that?
Right. Okay. So for me, the friends in my life, they, like everyone, they range. I have some that are more acquaintances that I can kind of see twice a year, and that's about the max. There are some that I can see once or twice a month, and that's great. But after I see them, I don't really want to see them the next day or the day after necessarily. Then there are some friends who I like to see a lot. I can see them Monday. I can see them again Tuesday. That's great. And of those friends, there are a few that I would say pass what I call the traffic test, which basically means you leave. It's just this hypothetical scenario. You leave a restaurant, and your car is they picked you up, and they're driving you back to your car. And there's a certain kind of friend, a certain quality of friendship and connection where you're really rooting for traffic when they're driving you because you're having so much fun talking to them. It could go on for another hour. The time is flying. You don't even feel like you've begun to get to all the things you want to talk about with them, even though you've been with them for 3 hours. And if there's traffic on the road, you're secretly happy. You say, oh, good, good. I'm going to have more time in this car. And that's really hard to find, as everyone can say. I mean, that's not an easy kind of friendship to find. Most friends, 3 hours is not only enough for that moment. You're ready to get in the car and leave that person. But, you know, really, you kind of, again, you're fine for the next week or 2 weeks of not seeing that person. So if you have someone in your life who you're rooting for traffic for or multiple friends, you've got to make sure your life partner is one of those people. That's the person you are spending every single day with, every single dinner with, or most of them. You're going on vacation for days and days and days. If that's not the kind of person that you just love spending time with and you can't get enough of it, what a shame. And that's a failure.
And that's an example of another thing you bring up, the idea that we need to think small when we're evaluating spending our lives with someone. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think this applies to a lot of things. It's not romantic. It's not really, definitely doesn't make for a good storybook romantic concept. But to me, life partnership is, in the end, yes, there are Valentine's days within there. Yes, there are. There's the honeymoon at the beginning, and there's going to be some amazing moments when you just have a really special night with your life partner. But almost the entire time you're going to spend with this person is going to be on what I call a forgettable Wednesday. a mundane weekday. That's life. In the end, it's 90 plus, maybe 99%+ of life is kind of just a day that's not really special. Nothing big happens, nothing that amazing happens, and it's just kind of a normal Wednesday. And if you the key in general, I'm thinking in life is just to make sure you can be happy on that Wednesday. That's not overjoyed. That's not realistic, but to be generally content,
be
enjoying yourself. And right, and so for with a life partner, got to think about not again, not oh wow, this is going to be the best person to climb Kilimanjaro with in that amazing trip we're going to take sometime in 10 years. That's not what you need to think about. It's on the 4,000th random Wednesday. Is this person just a really great part of that Wednesday? Are they making that Wednesday a little bit better? Are we just coexisting really easily and pleasantly? And is it a rich, you know, existence together on that Wednesday? And that's the fabric of life right there. That's what it's not. Again, it's not very romantic idea, but I think that's just reality. If you look at the percentage of your days, that's what most of them are like.
Here's a key that's been really important, I think, for my wife in finding me as a life partner, being ready to accept and maybe even appreciate flaws in the other person.
Yeah. Again, this is looking at this fact. Every single person in the world is flawed. And even some people, if flaw is a weird word, I mean, everyone just is a certain way. And there's no, it's, people are very complicated. There's not quality A, B, and C. No, there are hundreds of qualities of a human. There's them on their, when they're bored. There is how they are when they're anxious, when they're tired, when they're cranky, all these things. And you can call them flaws or whatever you want, but really it's just, it's not the best bite of the pizza. That's kind of the crust of the person. And there's all kinds of not so great parts of a human, and the person who's really going to get to know those parts better than anyone else ever will, is your life partner. And so it's got to be a situation where those things aren't such a conflict with the person that they cause continual fights, that you feel continually not accepted, not embraced, and you feel this pressure, this tension to kind of change and be different than who you are from this person. Likewise, you don't want to feel that. You don't want to feel like this person's going to be great. It's just as soon as they can change a little into this. And I'm just going to get them to kind of stop being this way, and then it'll be perfect. That's definitely not what people should be thinking about, because I don't really believe in the people don't change thing. Yeah, sure, people can change, but it comes from within, and it comes from their own desire for, you know, over lots of work and hard work on their own part. So, yes, I think it's critical to A, realize this, just understand this, that if you're trying to have a non-flawed human being as your life partner, you're going to search forever, because that's not possible. And B, you know, you want to find someone who their particular flaws kind of actually click with you, and you're kind of like, yeah, I get that. I get why they're like that, because I am like that sometimes. And hey, it's totally understandable. It's something you just accept in life, and that's really the only way to be.
So we've got these and some other criteria that we're looking for in a life partner, in a relationship. How do we expand our horizons to find a person who's a good match with that?
Yeah, so this is I just think, one of the craziest parts of our society, is that we're basically told, don't look too hard. Don't be organized in how you're looking. Definitely, you know, don't do anything too calculating in how you're trying to find the right person. Just be and exist, and it'll happen by itself. This is the advice even for people who don't like to go out to bars, who aren't that social, people who really are around their apartment a lot, or they're out with just a couple of good friends. Those people are still told, yeah, well, you know, you'll run into him or her somewhere. To me, that's just so ludicrous. It's as crazy as someone who's around their apartment being told, you know, your dream career will find you. Just do your thing, and your career will find you. That's, of course, not what you'd say, that you need to think about hard, what you're good at, what you like. You need to experiment. You need to try things. You need to get out there. You need to make it happen, and you need to be organized. You need to follow up with people. You need to build a network. You need to keep track of that network. That's how people are told to have a really good career, and you're supposed to really be the smartest human you can be about that and approaching it. With a life partner, that's even more necessary. And what society does is it tells you, if, you know, I used the hypothetical in the post, what if someone had a spreadsheet and they kept track of everyone they went on a date with and what went right and what went wrong, what they learned from it. That even someone listening right now to me is probably thinking, well, that's a little weird. And even I kind of think, well, that's a little it's only weird because society tells us that's not romance. This is romance. This is, you know, what are you doing? You're being way too rational. You're thinking too much. You're being way too organized about this. It's creepy. It's calculated. It's too cold and rational. One example of that's actually changing finally is that online dating for a long time had a stigma. And even just the word, it's called online dating. All it is online meeting people, and then in-person dating is what it actually is. And that's such an obvious thing. That's such a great way to, you can sort by, you know, a certain criteria. You can search for people who actually ring a bell with you and when you read their profile. And before you even go out with someone, you know you have a decent amount in common. You can expand well beyond your social networks. You can expand beyond who you happen to meet by luck. And if you're not someone who goes out a lot, you can. This is a great way to meet people and on a date. Only in a society that is really thinking about this the total wrong way would that ever have a stigma against it. So now, luckily, fortunately, that is seeming to change. I feel like the online thing is finally starting to just be accepted.
But. Well, Tim, I hope you help some people get smarter about this. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Have a great day.
That was Tim Urban, co-founder and writer at Wait But Why. You can find it at waitbutwhy.com. That was our Teach Me What You Know segment for the week, where we teach you how to do something, make maple syrup, do your taxes. Next week, how to fill out the forms and apply under the Affordable Care Act.